This is December 15th, 2013, and for Tay Show this morning I'm going to talk about Nelson Mandela and more broadly his triumph over his many sufferings at the hands of others and his transcendence of resentment and the remarkable things that he did. Somehow seems suitable that he's being memorialized now, so close to the holiday season, the Christmas season. The spirit of Christmas, unlike most of what we see about Christmas, the spirit of it is one of celebrating what is most noble in human beings, and benevolent, dana, that is giving, this first of the six paramitas in Buddhist teaching. His recent passing reminded me of an article from a long time ago, just 40 years now, that I've kept the whole time. It's an article that appeared in a journal of writings by Soviet dissidents. This was published in 1974. It's called Mystical Experiences of the Labor Camps. Before we get to that, just for those of you who possibly don't know, Nelson Mandela was convicted in mid-60s or something?
64,
yeah. He was tried for sabotage. He had been the leader of resistance to the government of apartheid in South Africa. And he was sentenced to life imprisonment in Robben Island Prison. He became prisoner 466-64. And he spent 18 years in a cell that was 8 feet by 7 feet. He was released only 27 years later, and the really stunning thing was his insistence that when he was out, his renunciation of any kind of revenge and his insistence on reconciliation with the oppressive government that had put him in there. It's really quite an amazing thing. So now back to this article called Mystical Experiences of the Labor Camps from 1974. It's published by a Mihailo Mihailov. And it's a review of the writings of those who had spent time in Soviet labor camps, Gulag, these terrible places, and the so-called mystical experiences they had there, and how they described them and what they went through. You know, I myself haven't heard much written about the experiences of Mandela and during those 27 years of prison, during which, by the way, he was tortured. He spent a lot of it in solitary confinement. There is a little bit here that I can't find it. All right, so I'm just going to wade into this article and read sections of it. This is quite a number of books that this author has read by these prisoners who survived, and not only survived, but spiritually thrived in these conditions, these terrible conditions. A lot of this is his conclusions that he came to. I got this article, by the way, from Roshi Kaplow 40 years ago, and was very much moved by the ways in which it confirms what we know about the power of mind. The vocabulary in this long article is based on Christian or Eastern Orthodox speech. That is, it's theistic, referring to God, but and the soul, which neither of which we have in Zen and Buddhism. But I'm just expecting that people can just make, who want to, can make the translation into, instead of soul, our true nature, perhaps. Same with God. And just, of course, just pulling this little fragments out of this long article, he reports that although they underwent the most extreme spiritual and physical suffering during their imprisonment, they also experienced a fulfilling happiness undreamed of by people outside the prison walls. None of these authors had ever before experienced such powerful feelings of love, hate, or despair, such days and nights filled with the most profound questions concerning human life, nor felt so close to the essence of cosmic life. Thus their descriptions of imprisonment are descriptions of an intense, concentrated life, a life which, despite all torment, was oddly precious. They affirm that those who have sacrificed their soul to save their body have lost both, while for those who were prepared to sacrifice their body to save their soul, some kind of strange and mysterious law, eluding understanding, preserved both. One of the many things I've heard about Mandela in these past 10 days or so is that when he was to be sentenced, he stood up and gave a long, long speech in which he stunned the courtroom by saying, "I am prepared to die for this stand that I've taken." There was the entire courtroom was stunned into silence. Even the judge couldn't speak, because apparently they just hadn't, that's the last thing they had ever imagined that he would say, that he was ready to die. And they didn't want to make a martyr out of him, apparently, so instead they sentenced him to life imprisonment at this leper colony called the Robben Island Prison, former leper colony. If a person follows the deeply rooted voice of his soul, which is not subject to any rational control, acting contrary to all exterior circumstances, contrary to his desires and plans, contrary to the threat of physical destruction, contrary to arguments and decisions of his intellect and the views of public opinion, then new courses open up in the life of such a person by inertia, which led to the preservation of all that had been sacrificed during the process of following this mystical compass. Even more, the most cherished spiritual aspirations are realized. Well, to have a free South Africa, a democratic South Africa, this is the amazing thing, is that that his 27 years imprisonment certainly would be a factor in what purified him, so that when he came out, he recognized that rather than having the bloodbath that it could easily have been, that he would have to find this this way of reconciliation, which went a long way to finally ushering in a democratic South Africa. There are ongoing problems, deep problems in South Africa, including with the organization of which Mandela was a part, the African National Congress. But they've come a long, long way from the brutal tyranny of the apartheid government. And man is free with respect to whether or not to follow this mysterious yet extremely real calling of his internal voice. More precisely, it should be said that a person becomes free after having experienced the suffering and mastering the terrible lessons of captivity. And here is perhaps the most paradoxical and optimistic conviction of those people who have themselves experienced the full force of evil on their own backs. This conviction is that the force of goodness is unconquerable, as Panin writes, is one of the authors who went through imprisonment, that the world more resembles a white tablecloth with a few specks of black evil and not the reverse, as Schifrin assures us, that the executioner executes himself while the one who is to be destroyed remains alive, to use the words of Grossman, that life is much more significant than we think, as Terts insists. He says it is seen that the struggle taking place between man and the forces of evil and death is least of all a strictly political struggle. On the surface, it indeed appears the discussion here centers on political collisions, that we speak about the rule of a one-party dictatorship, about the tyranny and uncontrolled practices of political police, about the lack of legal rights and freedom of speech. However, this is only the perceived side and social projection of a different struggle. This harsh and severe struggle is taking place in the depths of innumerable human souls, placed in a situation in which it is impossible to avoid participating. It is impossible to avoid making this fatal choice, to submit to the powerful, and to this day victorious, rule, force, coercion, or else to stand up against it, that is, to put one's faith with no guarantees in the existing internal voice. Now, many of you can also appreciate that from a Zen interpretation of all this writing is that we're working against the tyranny of the ego, of our deeply ingrained self-centeredness, our greed, anger, and delusion. This is the work we're all doing. We're all, to some degree, greater or lesser, we are captive to this ego self and its demands. But all of us, certainly, who practice, are taking a stand. The author goes on, it is very important to understand that sooner or later every human being will find himself in a prison, in a detention camp, or under the unlimited arbitrary rule of the mighty physical forces of this world. Then it is impossible to avoid the choice between submission before death, total destruction not only physically but also spiritually, or, in contradiction to everything real, objective, and sensible, to follow in a daring way the calling of the spiritual voice. Sickness, different catastrophes, various misfortunes, death, all of these are the very same as arrest, inquisition, prison, detention camp. And then in italics he writes, and it is not given to anyone to avoid them. So really, these authors are drawing from, though they're drawing from their long imprisonments under the most brutal conditions, like Mandela, really, all of this is about facing the loss of self, which one word for that is death, but also it's loss of one's freedom to just play out one's desires. Although people who have not gone through the experience of incarceration assume that there is a significant difference between the existence inside the prison and outside the prison walls, those who did go through the experience of incarceration have begun to understand that the difference is only superficial and temporary. For in one unexpected moment, for every human being, the world of freedom appears as in the cell of a prisoner condemned to death. He quotes Solzhenitsyn saying, "Our whole world is a prison cell of those condemned to death." And he goes on to say, Solzhenitsyn goes on to say, that the cell is crammed, but is not free will even more crammed? In other words, is our capacity for free will even exceeds the challenges that we face? Then the author poses the question, what happens when a person is thrust under the jurisdiction of merciless and powerful forces which appear to have only one wish, his destruction? Is any kind of defense or resistance possible? He says, he answers, again, based on these many books that he read of first-hand accounts, if a person attempts to resist in the sphere of that by which, until this time, he had lived and possessed, he is doomed to defeat from the very outset. The person himself is in no way capable of defending anything that the powerful external forces in whose grip he is now placed wish to take away. Thus, finding himself on the edge of an abyss, a person, before complete destruction, begins to understand that nevertheless something exists which is not within the realm of the external invincible forces. And even though all the rest can no longer be saved, resistance, fight, and victory are possible in one way, in the preservation of the soul, or to put it another way, which is, however, exactly the same thing, in safeguarding one's spiritual freedom and in resistance to evil and force. However, in order for this fight to be successful or even possible, one must renounce beforehand everything that the physical forces can take away. Here too, we can translate this in spiritual terms as renunciation of all that we cling to. I'm not talking about changing the way you live and quitting your job and becoming a monk. Those are nothing compared to renouncing our mental attachments. He quotes Solzhenitsyn again, only do not value life. Don't have anything. Renounce even your own body. Renounce everything. For even people who are close to you are your enemies. Here he means attachment, renouncing attachment to people who are close to you. Linqi, Zen master, Chinese Zen master Linqi, Rinzai, famously and controversially said, if you encounter the Buddha, kill the Buddha. If you encounter your parents, kill your parents. Of course, he's not speaking literally. But to give up your dependence on these notions. And Panin underscores this by attesting that in order to fight, it is essential to renounce even those who are close to you, to renounce everything under the sun except the soul. And only through this complete renunciation does a person become free. Only then, when he no longer has anything to lose. And at that instant, when this occurs, and this is the experience of many people on the brink of awakening, to finally be willing to die, figuratively speaking, to give it up, give up everything for Mu, for the breath, whatever our practice is, to finally let go one's clinging to thoughts and ideas, expectations, even hopes. At that instant when this occurs and the person becomes totally free, then in the experience of people who underwent this concentrated form of life, that is the maximum of non-freedom, the most mysterious aspect of their trial occurs. Some kind of all-powerful force appears in the depths of their soul. This force not only gives the mutilated body an incredible ability for resistance, but by some kind of utterly mystical means, begins to influence the external world. Let us repeat again, to influence and determine events which to our present-day consciousness appear to be independent of us, yet are nevertheless a saving force for him, the prisoner. Because of this, Panin kept repeating, redeem your soul and you will save your body. Only the spirit saves. The spirit supports the body, as Solzhenitsyn states many times. They both describe what they experienced personally or else witnessed with their own eyes, the incredible tenacity of a body possessed by strong internal spiritual intensity. Solzhenitsyn attests to a mysterious inner warmth which appeared as though from another world and saved a man in an ice box isolator. They used to, in the Soviet Gulag, they would put prisoners in like 0 degree boxes. They didn't have to. This was in Siberia. They didn't have to make them cold. Panin tells of an incomprehensible and unknown force which brought him back to life after 40 days oblivion. And he goes on narrating about a prisoner who rolled daily in the snow, stark naked, during bitter freezing weather without any harm to his health. When the individual threw everything physical aside and decided to follow the internal voice, which in itself is faith, he suddenly saw and felt in himself, quite empirically with joy, horror, and trepidation, this mysterious but at the same time real and powerful force which acted both in his body and in the external world. And simultaneously with this came the realization that he is not the owner of this force, that is, that it is not his prerogative to direct it according to his own judgment, but on the contrary, that everything in life, and life itself, is completely dependent upon this spiritual and mysterious force. This, over and over again, the author quoting these other first-person accounts of their overcoming the horrors of these Soviet labor camps. He talks about how mind affects things. Well, in Buddhism and Zen, we go further and we insist on this. What is beyond the simple causation of the causation of a mind-matter split, that there is ultimately no split between mind and physical things. As we say in affirming faith in mind, that things are things because of mind is mind because of things. I see one way to interpret this in terms of the remarkable events, the change in South Africa, even in our own lifetimes, was how this, during this 27 years of imprisonment, the forces of other nations, the protests, the cries, the sanctions, the economic sanctions against apartheid, how they grew and grew. The accounts that I read about Mandela this week pointed out that there was, for those all those years in prison, there was no photograph. People didn't see a current photograph of Mandela during his years in prison. There was the one, his defiant Mandela with his fist up going into prison, and then all those years later he emerged an old man. But somehow, because of his remarkable conviction and his courage, the anti-apartheid movement crystallized around him. He became the voice of anti-apartheid, and we see. Of course, we can't be sure that of any. We can't prove a causal connection between his own struggles to overcome those that imprisonment and what happened on the outside, but I think we can easily see them as related and ultimately not two. The transformation that he went through while incarcerated somehow mirrored that of his country and what it went through with the help of other countries. Have to point out that our own President Reagan vetoed the congressional vote to formally denounce the apartheid government of South Africa. This President Reagan, who people worship like a god. In fact, one of the articles I read is from the Washington Post. It's called Nelson Mandela and the Spiritual Legacy of Divestment. Divestment meaning the economic sanctions against South Africa that brought about enough pressure that they finally yielded and released Mandela ended the apartheid government. You know, everything that that this Mikhailo Mikhailov is presenting from the books of these prisoners really can be understood in a kind of a microcosmic level and as what goes on in this bare struggle against the forces of our own greed, anger, and delusion, the forces of the mind that are continually pulling us away from things as they are. It is a great struggle. The Buddha described it takes greater strength than the one person fighting off hundreds of enemies. This is not just something that happened in South Africa or happened in Siberia. This is what we are all in. This is the struggle we're all engaged with. And if you doubt the power of the habit forces of the mind, just keep sitting and go to Sesshin and you will see what we're up against in this struggle. And the author cites some of the practices that these prisoners got into. So both prayers and meditation, as well as the technique of yoga, were tested and subject to verification. Not only the Old and New Testaments found written down on small scraps of paper, recorded by memory, but also everything bound with the ancient teaching of yoga, with parapsychology, with theosophy, appeared as the most essential and necessary practical means for the protection of both the soul and the body. Under such circumstances, the action of the spirit triggered a direct effect seen by people with our own eyes on the physical world. So this is not like bending spoons or doing weird things like that. But this is far greater. This was a sea change, a world change in attitude towards South Africa. Quote Solzhenitsyn as saying, under pressure of both physical and spiritual suffering, a person loses the coat of mail of evil energy. Pannon, one of the other authors, says that spiritual energy, in a manner analogous to electricity, is used up in the work of the intellect. And then the author cites the book by Tolstoy called The Death of Ivan Ilyich. He says, one recalls the death of Ivan Ilyich, in which Tolstoy, describing the unbearable spiritual suffering of the dying man, says that at a specific moment, Ivan Ilyich understood that, in itself, death is not frightening. The main and fundamental basis of his suffering is buried in the type of life he led. He lived in sin, obviously not with regard to the commonly accepted moral and ethical norms, but in relationship to the inner voice, that voice about which we are speaking. Sin, we can translate in Zen terms as separation. And Ivan Ilyich felt during his hour of death that the only real relief came to him in rare moments of his life when he was following the inner voice, that is, one with one's life, and not the popularly accepted opinions and customs, for example, some kind of youthful love and friendship. This very same thing is substantiated in the experiences of those who survived the maximum loss of freedom. It was not the imprisonment that was frightening, but the life led prior to the arrest. On numerous occasions, they all, especially Solzhenitsyn and Gulag, described that spiritual suffering which was brought out through the recollection of pre-prison life, about sinning with respect to one's own soul, which meant sinning with respect to other people as well. So betraying what we know to be the way, the Tao, which is non-separation from the direct experience of life, not fleeing into thoughts. This is what a transcendent experience reveals, is what a false world that is, that most of us live in all the time, lost in our thoughts about future and past. He says, one way or another, those who have undergone the anguish of maximum non-freedom agree that a person, while in prison, saw himself as through a magnifying glass and experienced the most meaningful moments of his lifetime, to use Solzhenitsyn's words. This is Sashin. And Tertz corroborates this, saying, a person while in prison is the most complete person. Of course, you can't compare Sashin to prison in the respect that we voluntarily and very wisely enter into Sashin. But it's still we sign a promise that we will not leave Sashin before the time we've committed to. And this makes it, in a way, a kind of an elevated version of imprisonment, a benevolent version of that, where we have made the commitment and we are bound to see it through until the end. Like Shifrin, Solzhenitsyn testifies that in the prison, both he and others simultaneously pass through the process of corruption and ascent. A movement of goodness within the soul began. The person grew more tolerant and patient. In other words, after ongoing suffering, a person began to become good. Solzhenitsyn writes that all prisoners are individuals, that people in prison ennoble themselves and develop into interesting human beings, that the strongest love exists in prison camps. Here I think of Mandela, and again, I don't know does anyone know really what he went through in all those years, but he certainly emerged a different person than the Mandela who went in. The Mandela who went in was heroic enough in his willingness to give up his life in the cause of freedom for his people. But the one who emerged, it seems to have been someone purified and even far beyond the one who went in. In contrast to the life of freedom perceived by people who are not imprisoned, who do not understand the most important questions facing us, and hence live as though in a dream, prison life appears as the only real life, with the occupants being awakened from the dream. Suffering had unlocked the way to true freedom, liberating man from everything external and superfluous in life, most significantly from service and veneration of the idol of worldly power, because, as the analysis had shown, all these idols were powerless to save us during the hour of death. And then he quotes Solzhenitsyn, "Spiritual slavery is finished once and for all." And he blesses the prison. The news reported that Mandela invited his jailers to his inauguration when he became president of South Africa. What greater model of forgiveness can we possibly find? In an article from the New York Times of December 5th, the author, John Dramani Mahama, said that Mandela insisted on forgiveness. To go to prison because of your convictions and be prepared to suffer what you believe in is something worthwhile. It is an achievement for one to do his duty on earth irrespective of the consequences. In the same New York Times article, we read, "It is no coincidence that in the years since Mandela's release, so much of Africa has turned toward democracy and the rule of law." Here again, the ability to affect so-called physical things, the world. "His utilization of peace as a vehicle of liberation showed Africa that if we were to move beyond the divisiveness caused by colonization and the pain of our self-inflicted wounds, compassion and forgiveness must play a role in governance. Countries, like people, must acknowledge the trauma they have experienced, and they must find a way to reconcile, to make what was broken whole again. I'm just going to close with a few words about forgiveness in general, because many people will find, or some people in this holiday season when they get together with family, will find an opportunity to draw from this human capacity for forgiveness, from the trauma or even just the ordinary pain of family life. It's an interview here in the New York Times of a Robert Caron, a psychotherapist in Manhattan, who wrote a book called The Forgiving Self, The Road from Resentment to Connection. Question: most people think about forgiveness as a virtue, even if they have trouble being forgiving themselves. But is it always a good thing to forgive? And this doctor says, we aren't saints and we aren't meant to be. Forgiveness that comes out of a sense that I should forgive because it's right, or forgiveness that is compliant or automatic, is worse than no forgiveness at all, because it covers something over and leaves people less connected than they were before. One of the misconceptions about forgiveness is that if you are a nice person, you just do it. What gets overlooked is that forgiveness usually entails an important internal process, and that this process can go on for a long time and needs to be respected. A long time, like 27 years. A long time, like years of practice. Question: you write about forgiveness as a process that involves not only the injured person, but also the person who did the injuring. Why is that? Answer: forgiveness too often gets framed as an issue of a victim and a wrongdoer. There are certainly many cases of that. But in most people's lives, I think forgiveness is an issue whenever two people are in conflict. Who needs to forgive and who needs to apologize is often a toss-up. In most situations, everyone shares the blame to some extent. Well, this is pure Buddhist understanding that, as sixth patriarch Wei Nung said, when others are wrong, I too am responsible. When I am wrong, I alone am to blame. I wonder if Nelson Mandela, in the course of those years in prison, came to see his own responsibility in what had landed him there. I don't know enough about what that responsibility might have been, but in Buddhism we always have the responsibility of what we've done in a past life. Later in this interview with this Dr. Robert Caron, question, there's been quite a bit of research over the last few years on the health benefits of forgiveness. I think probably many people listening to this talk have heard about this. Do you think that forgiving makes people healthier? Answer, it's probably true that being a good forgiver correlates with lower blood pressure and less internal wear and tear. There's plenty of evidence that our emotions affect our physical well-being. But talking about it this way bothers me, because it suggests that the only reward to leading a healthy emotional life is that you live longer. This is what bothers me about all the talk, the increasing body of research showing the health benefits of meditation, the emotional benefits, you know, all benefits to oneself. Great, that's good, fair enough. Who wouldn't want all that? But it's such a diminishment of the promise of Zen meditation, Buddhist meditation, which is really ultimately about helping others, not just becoming more becoming healthier and happier yourself. He then goes on, also linking forgiveness with physical health can be confusing to people. What's healthy is finding a way to embody and live through our secure and loving selves. But being able to live more through that part of yourself is not something you just decide to do. It develops out of a real struggle with your own psychology. It's not like, well, I'm going to be more forgiving now because my blood pressure is too high. Question, are there some situations where it's better not to forgive? Answer, I think there is a big difference between forgiving and welcoming someone back into your life. You can recognize that this is a person whom I love and whom I've cared about tremendously, and I really want the best for him, but I can't live with what he does. I can't stay married to him because it's too hurtful and he doesn't seem to get it. So just to restate that, forgiving doesn't mean, say, forgiving a toxic person doesn't mean inviting him to live with you. And then finally, what if someone finds it impossible to forgive, no matter how much he wants to? Answer, if you can't find it in your heart to forgive, it's better not to, and see where that takes you, than to force yourself into an unnatural type of forgiveness. There are cases where you never forgive and you don't want to forgive, but it doesn't really interfere with your life. But if it becomes this gnawing resentment that lives with you, then you've never gotten over being a victim. And in that way, not forgiving can be a horrible thing for the person who doesn't forgive. There was another case of a wrongly convicted prisoner who went through a tremendous transformation while in prison. This was a story on CNN. If anyone has cable, I really recommend seeing this. It's a story about a guy by the name of Michael Morton, whose wife was brutally murdered in their suburban home, and he was wrongfully convicted of the murder and spent 25 years in prison. The first five, he said, as a lot of it is him speaking, the first 5 years he just was filled with hate toward those who had withheld evidence and falsified things just to get a conviction. And then he had an experience in prison. It was just a remarkable, inspiring testimony he gives. Experience of what he described as having seen God. And everything changed for him then. Then he made peace with his incarceration. I doubt that he could draw from the law of karma as a way of an explanation of how this terrible thing had happened to him, this terrible injustice. But finally, the Innocence Project, through their support behind his case, and he was exonerated on the basis of DNA evidence. But what was one of the most amazing, memorable things about this story is to see him. He's lit up from the inside, this man, after these half a quarter of a century in prison and having had this experience there. And then the kicker comes at the very end. They've gone through all the credits, and then at the very end it shows him now on the witness stand of the trial of one of the prosecuting attorneys who had withheld evidence. And he's still beaming. He still has this radiance about him. And he says something like, have him suffer the consequences, the penalty of having done this, but please be gentle with him. And then one last thing. Question, but forgiveness doesn't come instantly, does it? Answer, Usually it takes a long time before we discover the love of someone who has hurt us. First comes anger, and very often a sense of persecution. We go through all the typical horrible stuff to which human nature and human psychology are prone. We can only wonder what stuff Nelson Mandela went through in that prison. But he emerged, great inspiration to all of us. And we will have a memorial service after the Sangha meeting this morning for people who want to stay. I don't want to have the center get in the habit of doing memorial services for admirable public figures, presidents and prime ministers and others, but I really felt this was a place to make an exception. Mandela was not a Buddhist, but he sure embodied many of the virtues of the Buddhist faith. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.